monthly podcast on the spoken word. Episode number 83, December 2024. Just how boring are you? Be a better podcast guest. A conversation with Jeremy Fisher and Gillian Kayes. Hello, Paul Meyer here. First, a shout out to the Florida Studio Theatre in Sarasota. I've just finished coaching a remarkable play for them, The Heart Sellers, by Korean-American playwright Lloyd Soo, S-U-H, directed by Kate Alexander and starring Michelle Hira Kim and Rona Figueroa as the two Korean and Filipina characters. The show runs December 11th, 2024, through February 16th, 2025. I strongly recommend this production. And thank you to Mark Byron Dallas. He wrote me after the last podcast, sending along a graph from linguist Peter Trudgill, tracing how British bands, the Rolling Stones and the Beatles' pronunciation in their songs, dramatically evolved away from American pronunciation towards their own British sounds by just 6 years later. We put that chart on the webpage for episode number 82 with Karen Burgos. Thanks for that, Mark. This is my final podcast before the holidays, so happy holidays to all my listeners. Marking the season, I'm again offering my accents and dialects for stage and screen, the deluxe streaming edition, for $10 off through January 3rd. 27 of the accents and dialects actors need most. Get the same discount at paulmeyer.com for the printed version and on your iTunes account if you prefer the iTunes ebook, Apple Book version. And, as in previous years, I've just made my audiobook reading of Charles Dickens' beloved A Christmas Carol absolutely free until January 3rd. Go to paulmeyer.com/Christmas Carol, all lowercase, no spaces. This is Dickens' original and uncut text. Now, guess that accent. Last time I played this clip from the Idea Archive and challenged you to say where on the planet the speaker grew up.
Oh, yes, I'll read you this now. I'm very well, thank you. There's nothing the matter with me. I'm as healthy as can be. I've arthritis in both knees, and when I talk with a wheeze. My pulse is weak and my blood is thin, but I'm awfully well for the shape I'm in.
What was your guess? It was Ideas, England, 55. For the full recording and all the documentation, go to Accents and Dialects on the menu tab of dialectsarchive.com, then Europe, then England, then Yorkshire and Humber. I recorded this myself on a dialect gathering field trip 20 years ago in 2004. The subject was born in Greetland, West Yorkshire, in 1912, making her 91 years old at the time. Idea and this podcast are, of course, totally free. I mention this because we're currently holding the biannual Idea fundraiser to coincide with Giving Tuesday, which is December 3rd. So if you enjoy this podcast and the archive and have never made a donation, click the Support Idea link that appears on every page of the archive. No gifts too small. Thanks in advance. Now this month's challenge. Where did this speaker spend his formative years?
We spent a lot of time going to the forest and to the beach and down to the small river. I had a small boat, so I went fishing most of the time. And the homework that I did make, I very often read it down in my boat. We often went to the beach. And generally speaking, I mean, it was another time because we didn't have computers or phones. And we had to, like, use our imagination, I think, more than children do today.
What's your guess? Get the answer next time. If you aren't listening to me on paulmeyer.com, switch over now. Select In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services menu tab, then click episode number 83. You'll find lots of details about my guests and other relevant audio and video links, not available on any other podcast channel. And you can subscribe from any page of the website. My guests this month are my old friends, internationally renowned singing and voice teachers, coaches, authors, Gillian Kayes and Jeremy Fisher, making their third appearance on In a Manner of Speaking. Speaking and Singing, episode number 18, was their first, followed by Pitch, episode number 48. This episode is devoted to Jeremy's latest book, Just How Boring Are You? Welcome back, Jeremy and Julianne.
Thank you, Paul. It's lovely to be back.
It's always a pleasure, Paul.
Always, always.
I have a question for you. Just how boring are you?
Shall we find out?
It's a terrific little book. Thank you so much for writing it. Great title. Why did you write it?
I was actually asked to become the podcast sort of lecturer expert in a conference, an online conference. And so I did the interview and then I wrote the book.
All right. So it's pitched towards improving people's podcast guest skills. Now, of course, you two are perfect exemplars. But why pitch it just at podcast guests? Why not to everybody who wants to speak more vividly, memorably, arrestingly?
There is a lot of crossover between speech making and interview technique and podcasting. But podcasting has some absolutely specific stuff, part of which, of course, is microphone use.
And the thing is, there's a huge explosion of podcasters. And yes, a lot of people go on as guests. They go onto podcasts as guests because they've written an interesting book.
Mm.
And the book is fascinating, but sometimes the podcasting interviews aren't.
Yes.
You're absolutely right. The fact that you've deduced this market is ripe for the plucking tells us exactly how many podcasts there are and how many people are being podcast guests.
Yes.
But of course, from the advice you give to podcast guests and in training, it's easy to extrapolate that to the general speaker in all contexts, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm.
Yeah. There are so many techniques and sort of the way that you understand how people hear and also how you deliver information that goes across the board.
Before we go any further, remind us how to get a copy of the book, please.
We can put a link on your show notes, hopefully. You can get it online. It's a PDF. And in fact, it does come with an entire vocal warm-up that I deliver with MP3s. So you don't just read the book. You hear me taking you through the warm-up as well.
Ah, right. Nothing like the sound of the voice when you're writing a book about the voice, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm looking at the table of contents of the book. We can zip through there and see what needs to be said. So I want to be a great podcast guest. So elaborate on that.
Yeah, often people will have a topic or a book or something that they want to pass on to people. And this book was written specifically for people who'd written something, but then weren't really very good at talking about it.
Writers, not necessarily speakers, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So I want to be a great podcast guest is the place to start, because if you're going to go onto a podcast, you need to be interesting. You know, that's in a way, that's the reason that you're there. Podcast is essentially entertainment and it's also a conversation.
Yes. Tricky, isn't it?
Yeah.
If we go back to the years of the pandemic, when all of us had to be online in one way or another, you know, there was a huge explosion of online activity. A lot of it started to focus on podcasting. So I personally follow quite a few medical people.
Mm.
Because I'm very interested in how medics translate their wisdom for the general community so that we can mind our well-being, so to speak. Mm. And some of those medics are very good on podcasts and some of them are not. I think this book is very necessary for our times.
Mm. Chapter 4, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit, but if I miss something interesting, of course, just go where you need to. But I hate the sound of my voice on recordings. That's a familiar one, isn't it? Almost universally, people say, unless people are in the business and have trained their voices and are used to their own voices, they hate to hear their own voices. That's something to get over, isn't it?
In 2023, there was a study of voice satisfaction and voice enhancement, which used 1,522 people. Basically, they recorded themselves and then played the recordings back. And it was 57.5% reported dissatisfaction with their voice. That's enormous.
And none of them had any type of voice disorder.
No, they all had healthy voices. It's sort of three things, really. When we hear ourselves talking, we are only hearing internal resonance. Mm. And therefore, you're not hearing what the person in front of you is hearing. And when your voice is recorded, it's usually the first time that people hear
how other people sound. Hear them, right?
Yeah, how they sound to someone else.
That should be very reassuring to people and help them to get past that phobia.
I hope so, because you know, it's a given, it's a fact. There's nothing you can do about that. You hear yourself differently to the way other people hear. And I hear my voice as a lot lower and richer than everybody else does. So I'm a basso profundo in my, I mean, really big, round, warm sound in my ears because that's all I'm hearing. Mm. I'm hearing all of my dark harmonics, all of the richness and depth in the sound, but I'm not hearing the bright harmonics right. that other people do.
Yeah, and that is partly to do with bone conduction.
Yeah, so the sound travels from the vocal cords through the tissues to the ear, right, through bone and all the other tissue that lies between.
Yes. And in fact, we hear our voices outside in our ears slightly later than we hear it inside. So there's also a sort of weird stereo effect.
No, I didn't know that. That's interesting. So let's get on to the real topic. People want to be fascinating. They want to be memorable. They want their information to be delivered clearly. They want to cast their spell over the listener, of course. So yeah. I sound so boring. Let's talk about the role that pitch. We've done a podcast on pitch, highest notes and lowest notes and all kinds of other information. But let's go back to why pitch is so important to not being boring.
Well, if I stay around the same pitch most of the time, then I haven't even finished the sentence yet, but you can tell that I don't really have that much that's interesting to say. So I'm speaking on pretty much the same pitch the whole time. And this is the thing, there is no variation, there's no dynamics, there's nothing that the listener's ear can tune into. It's just a sort of bit of noise, really, and it really acts just as much background as anything else.
And you have to infer the important words, because nothing's been given you to isolate or foreground the interesting, important words.
Yes.
You picked up on exactly my thought and framed it very nicely there, Paul. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I mean, the whole thing about pitch use is really fascinating. And I think different countries have slightly different pitch uses. So we're going to stick with English for the moment. So the UK.
Yes.
We use pitch a lot.
Yes.
We use pitch to emphasize things really quite in quite a big way.
Even a basso profundo would use very high notes sometimes.
Absolutely, yeah.
Americans seem a little bit more afraid. American men seem to be a little afraid of those high notes. I have a little hard time introducing them to the fact that they won't lose their masculinity if they use some high notes occasionally. Yeah,
I think there's also something interesting in America in general. You tend to use more volume to emphasize than pitch.
Yes, yes.
Which is actually, it's quite fascinating. And also, if you go to Mandarin Chinese, then people use different pitch in a phrase will actually give a word an entirely different meaning. So pitch is really linked to meaning.
Yes, absolutely.
And I have in the book, I have one example in Mandarin, which is ma, which can mean mother, hemp, horse, or scold.
Yeah, yeah.
Entirely different meanings depending on which pitch and which shape you use.
Tonal languages, yes, yes.
Yes. In terms of pitch patterns.
Yes, yes, let's do that.
You know, the pitch pattern thing, and we do an exercise, which I think is from one of our books. I think it's from This Is a Voice, which is Feed the Dog. Do you remember Feed the Dog?
I do remember Feed the Dog. And this is where, obviously, you know, with all three of us having had a background in theatre, the intention is so important. And I think often the general public who haven't trained in that tradition don't realise the variety that can come from different intents when you say a sentence.
So if we take Feed the Dog as a literal sentence, if I said to you, feed the dog, that's got quite a definite, specific meaning.
Yes.
And I'm going, da, da, da. So it's two notes and then one lower. Feed the dog.
I told you before.
Absolutely, yes.
Feed the dog, right.
Yeah. But if I do, feed the dog, come on.
For God's sake, you can do it.
That's da, da, da. So you got two high notes, one lower note, and then I come back up again.
Yeah.
And just doing that pitch, we're using exactly the same wording, but using pitch gives it an entirely different backstory, if you like. It's an entirely different meaning.
There's a lot of information that's conveyed on the pitch.
Yes.
Very much so.
Which is why I always argue with my Shakespeare clients that it's not just to make the speech prettier that we insist on a lot of pitch variety. It's because there's a lot of meaning to be conveyed.
Yes.
By that, the architecture of the argument is revealed through the pitch more than any other dynamic. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. Yes, definitely. Because both of us are musicians, because we're keyed into melody, melody and meaning are very closely linked in the speaking voice. And I love playing with changing the melody of a sentence. I think it gives you such a variety of things that you can say.
Yeah. I sound so boring. Pace.
Mm-hmm. Pace is so fascinating. Pace is the speed at which you talk, but also the speed of the, if you like, the gaps between the words as well. There is a wonderful exercise that you're going to have to imagine because I can't stand up and do it. But imagine that you're standing on a street corner and you're watching people walk past. Everybody walks at a particular pace. And so it's like you have a limerick or a poem in your head, and you say the poem in your head and you match the speed that someone walks at. And then you shift your gaze onto somebody else and you match their speed. It's a really fascinating exercise to find how you can make speed of speaking work.
You know, with all of these dynamics that we're discussing, there's a quality that if you're reading an audiobook or an extended narration or you're on a podcast for an hour or more, if you deliver what the listener has become accustomed to in your pace and your pitch and your rhythm, there's a sense that, oh, I know where he's going. I'm used to this sound. And we sacrifice the element of surprise. So surprising the listener with sudden changes of dynamics, suddenly going higher where they didn't expect it, or suddenly pausing where they didn't expect it, almost re-engages them. What do you think?
Absolutely. It's a real attention getter. There's an exercise that I've used for somebody giving a speech. And there's a really fascinating thing about speech making as opposed to audiobook reading. Speech making is, it has a very clear job to do. And you've still got to stay dynamic. You've got to stay interesting. And I've got somebody to practice maybe four or five lines of their speech, speaking along to different recordings of music. Let's say you're on something like laid-back jazz and you match the mood and the feel and the speed that that jazz does for you, and you deliver your speech with that, or you go to something military and martial and you deliver your speech with that, or you go to something really up-tempo and you go with that. And it gives you such insight into what you can do with text.
Yes. I'm just flashing on the movie The King's Speech, when the stuttering King George was practicing a speech and listening to music in his headphones and no stutter.
Yes.
I'd forgotten this, Paul. Yes. Almost everybody listens to music. They relate to music. They will have a relationship to certain types of music. Why don't you get them to do this as an exercise?
And now you're reminding me of what we discussed in one of our other podcasts, is that nudging speech to the boundary with music makes the speech irresistible. You cannot resist music. You cannot argue with music. You cannot say, no, you're wrong. It's incontrovertible in a sense.
Yes.
So the more music that we bring into our speech without becoming melodic and actually starting to sing, the more the secret of spellbinding is available to you.
We've just been talking about pace, but I'm thinking of rhythm. And pace is part of rhythm. There's one thing that will make you sound boring, and that is to keep the same rhythm all the time. So if I said to you that I'm going to do this, and it's the same thing each time, and you know that I'm going to do it, and it just keeps happening, and at some point you're going to start switching off because I'm doing exactly the same pattern all the time. The only place that it really works well is in a speech where you're doing emphasis and you have maybe three or four things that you want to get across, and you do exactly the same thing whenever you're talking about it, and you're doing this and then you talk about that and everything is the same. Then you're using repetition for emphasis.
One of the most important rhetorical devices, in fact, is mm-hmm. to repeat the same idea in a slightly different form, but on the same rhythm, on the same melody. You're invoking the power of the list, as I like to say, the magic three. Yeah, fantastic. You've got another chapter, I Sound So Boring, Pause.
Yes.
This has got to be the importance of silence, right?
It is, but there is a snag with podcast broadcasts, which is, and particularly now we have AI doing the editing, which is any pause longer than 2 seconds just gets cut. So if you're going to do a pause somewhere, it has to be filled with meaning, just to make sure it doesn't get cut out. But there are different versions of the pause.
Oh, tell me.
The obvious version is where you stop speaking, so there is silence. You can usually do that maybe just before something that you're going to say, something absolutely specific, which I just did then.
Yes. That keeps us on the edge of our seats. Ooh, what's he going to, how's he going to complete this thought that he's just making up? Yes, nice.
Yes, yeah. There's another version, which is a really weird one because it does come under pause, but it doesn't sound like it. And that's when you say something in order to give yourself time to think. So if you asked me a question and I went, oh, that's a great question. That is essentially a pause for your brain to go, I have no idea what he's just said, but I'm sure I can make something up. Just give me 10 seconds to think about it.
That is essential because somebody might well throw something at you and you really don't know how to respond.
Yeah.
How much would you rely on the editing suite to take out the boring, inessential pauses?
If it's me editing, most of them. If it's somebody else editing, you're entirely reliant on whether they... Oh, I mean, this is the interesting one. Because a lot of people are using AI more to edit their podcasts, and I use it to a certain extent, there is a setting on a lot of editing programs where you just go, any pause more than 2 seconds gets cut. Or any pause more than 3 seconds gets cut. I have to say, since podcasting is essentially an audio thing, so there aren't normally any visuals, silence is quite challenging to the listener because you could easily think, oh, my signal's gone. So you've got to be quite careful with silence in a podcast. Silence in a speech is very effective.
Yes. I'm going to talk about the reverse of that. Sometimes I've edited so much, it seems breathless. No one's got any time for breath. So I go back and actually put pauses back in. The pause that refreshes, as it were.
Yes. That's so nice, Paul, because the audience needs time to process. And a silence can give them time to process.
I think they also want to know that you're human. So, for example...
But you actually breathe.
I don't know how many of my ums you're going to need to remove from this podcast, but I'm a terrific ummer, aren't I?
You are. I normally remove about 150 ums from Gillian.
But he puts them back in as well.
I do.
Because it is being human.
Yeah,
absolutely. I remember talking to a pianist colleague of mine, and we were talking about breath and contrasting how, of course, a keyboard doesn't require breathing like a wind instrument of some kind, or the human voice, which, of course, you have to pause to breathe. And he said that even in piano playing, the piece of music has to breathe. Your musicians, talk to me about how a piano breathes.
If you think of music as being a paragraph, piece of music is a paragraph, or it's a whole, whatever, novel. But if you think about it as a paragraph, then a paragraph has punctuation, it has full stops, it has commas. And what you're doing when you're using words, either in writing or speaking, you are shaping thoughts. The thoughts may be connected, in which case they may run together, or they might have just a comma between them, or the thoughts may be entirely separate, in which case you put a full stop. Musical phrasing is exactly the same. There are some phrases that go together and therefore you can play them without a break. And there are some phrases that it's like, and now I'm starting again, or this is a new thought, or this is a development. It's exactly the same.
And breath, of course, is spirit, spiritus, isn't it? If people have snipped all the breath pauses out of a piece of recording, then it becomes breathless in that sense. We need to put the spirit back in, need to hear them breathing in spirit in order to deliver the next idea. Yeah.
It's sort of how you are making your audience feel.
Mm.
And if you're doing unexpected breaths, that can be very useful occasionally. But if you do it all the time, that puts your audience on edge.
And of course, once you're conscious of breathing, you can think of nothing else. And that is a little bit destructive of the flow of thought, too. So that's why we go to school. We train as singers and actors, and so that all of this can become second nature. Chapter 8, I sound so boring. Power, what do you mean?
Power is, in general, how loud you speak. I'm going to tell you a story about the first time that I did a radio interview. I was prepared, you know, I'm working my voice. I have a very clear voice and it's very strong. And I went into the studio and I'm like, I'm prepared to project into the microphone. I know exactly what I'm doing. And then I heard the host talk, and the host was very close mic'd and actually did this type of sound. And I went, oh, all my knowledge is not necessary because it was the wrong sound for the wrong occasion. So the question really is, how loud do you need to talk and when?
Agreed. And I remind my clients that when they speak, my ears are the same distance from them as their mouth to the microphone. So it's that intimate a medium, isn't it?
Yes.
And the three of us are talking together with that intimacy in mind, suiting our level of power to the proximity of the listener's ear.
Yes.
Is resonance somewhere in there? When I saw power, I thought, this has got to be something to do with making your voice thrillingly resonant and not scratchy. So where does the idea of a full-bodied voice, good resonance, where does that fit into our spellbinding prowess?
I was thinking, did you cover that in tone?
I think so, yes.
Yes,
I think I cover it later.
I think for, you know, the everyday human in the street who hasn't had any voice training and isn't aware of those things, I think we decided to go for tone of voice might be a better way to deal with that.
There's an interesting one about power. If just take power as literally how loud or how soft you're speaking, then there are moments when you might want to get slightly louder for emphasis. It's another way of emphasizing things. We've talked about the podcast in particular being, because you're very close mic'd, being an intimate form. And in fact, just a by the way, when you think about people listening to a podcast, you are in their ears and in their houses and in their rooms for 20 minutes to an hour. It's an amazing way of people getting to know you. And it's also an amazing way of you getting into people's lives because you sound like you're just there. I've calmed the power down a bit just to talk about that. I haven't calmed my diction down, but I have calmed my volume down.
Interesting. Yes. I was just listening to your voices and finding that although you're very intimate and therefore rather quiet, you don't lack any resonance. So I think a lot of people, when they think of whispering or going quiet, you know, they suddenly start to lose resonance. If you can be quiet and resonant.
I mean, I'm glad you've raised it because in a sense, what we're saying is it's not just about volume. This is, for me, about finding the space inside. So you're quite right, Paul. When people are feeling that they're too loud because they're close-mic'd, what then often happens is they'll squeeze from inside and they're sort of trying to hold everything back. Mm-hmm. Whereas in fact, what you need to do is to find space inside, you know, right inside the pharyngeal area and perhaps in the mouth as well, so that you can deliver at those lower levels of volume but still have, I don't know, I'd say a telling tone.
It's presence at quiet volume.
Mm.
Presence at quiet volume. That's amazing, yes. Let's talk about passion, because without a passion for your topic, what good is it, right?
There's a whole thing here, which is how do you find passion? I'm going to stick with podcasting for the moment, but actually it's the same doing interviews, doing auditions, doing speeches. There needs to be an element of I love what I'm doing, or I'm interested in what I'm doing, or I'm passionate about what I'm doing. And the question is, how do you find that? I mean, it's so easy when somebody has written a book, because usually people write a book because they want to. It's a long, drawn-out process. And so normally they're quite interested in what they're writing. The trick is to be able to take the interest that you have in the topic that you know about and deliver it in spoken format. And that's a completely different format from writing.
Absolutely.
It's one of the reasons I love writing, because you can form a sentence, you can sculpt it, you know, you're sure of the meaning of it. The difficulty, if you like, with an interview or a podcast or anything that's live like this.
Impromptu, unscripted, yes.
Yes, you are essentially improvising. One of the things about doing, let's say, podcasting or anything that's live, anything that's sort of interactive like this is that you are essentially improvising. And if you have a passion about your topic, if you know what you're talking about, if you really want to share, and that's really the point of doing something like this, is you want to share something, then the passion that you have will be there. You just have to learn how to deliver a story or to choose a point about what you've written about or what you know, and do that in a way that is easy for people to understand so that they can follow where you're going. There are things that you can practice in that. I have an exercise about taking a topic and just saying one sentence about it, and then going back, saying the same sentence and adding another sentence about it. And then you go back and you repeat those two sentences and you add another one. You only have to do that four or five times, and you start to get into the swing of being able to chat about what it is that you're talking about.
That sounds like very much like something that Renaissance folks would do. They would train for being fascinating conversationalists. They would improvise on topics. It was part of the training, but we don't seem to have that tradition anymore. In fact, people mistrust eloquence, don't they? And the word rhetoric has a pejorative connotation instead of a positive one. So why have we lost our respect for fluency and eloquence and elegance of speech, I wonder? It's a topic I've raised in many podcasts, so you've got to be the ones who settle the argument.
I think it's got to be because we're living in a digital age where everything is thrown at us on screen. A single picture with nice, interesting text is not enough. It's got to be a video. There's got to be something moving that grabs people's attention. And I think it's got to be to do with that. And I mean, I think it's been a really big cultural change.
I think that's part of it. I don't think it's the whole thing. When you think about the social media thing that Gillian's talking about, I think the difficulty for people who are growing up in this age now is that literally everything they've done and said is now available and recorded and there for life. And so people get quite careful about what they say. But I just want to go to somewhere else, which is, I think people mistrust glossy. I think they recognize if something has been rehearsed and they don't like it. I think there's something about the whole improvisation thing, which is, if it really does sound like it's off the top of your head, it's the first time you've said something, then people are involved. If they think you've rehearsed it, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, we're talking here about the difference between reading a text aloud and speaking. And so much of my work, and I bet yours too, is devoted to taking a prepared text, be it a piece of music or be it the written language. The important thing is to get it off the page, isn't it? To make it sound as if for the first time. To turn the reading of a prepared text into something that sounds a little bit closer to spontaneity and improvisation.
And there is a very big difference. When people read something off the page, they tend to go into a reading voice or a reading pattern.
Generally slower, right? Yes,
generally a little bit more sing-song. Or it can be sort of artificial. If this is you, you are not alone. Many experts are so expert in their field that they either have no time for people who aren't, or they're so embedded in the detail that they can't see or describe the big picture. It's sort of slightly sing-song, and it doesn't have a natural pattern. It has a slightly artificial pattern.
Okay, Jeremy, read that same piece again, but make it sound a little closer to that it's coming out of your head spontaneously.
If this is you, you are not alone. Many experts are so expert in their field that they either have no time for people who aren't, or they're so embedded in detail that they can't see or describe the bigger picture.
Bravo. That's amazing. Wonderful. I'm going to bottle that and sell it. Royalties to you.
I have to tell you, I was not prepared for that. That was genuine improvisation.
I'm so glad Paul put you on the spot, because
it's normally me that puts you on the spot.
Yes, it is. It's true. But I was thinking that, you know, if people are reading this book and they're going through this, I know my subject, but it, I mean, is this an exercise that you might give them?
Yes.
To just read something from the book and now tell me about it.
There's also something really fascinating about the way that you read and what's written. And I had this with a client who was doing a massive speech in America to a whole bunch of financial gurus. And he'd got his speech and he was doing quite well. But I said to him, that doesn't sound like you. And it turns out every time I picked up a sentence that I said, that doesn't sound like you, somebody else had written that sentence. Mm. And I think it's a much bigger skill to be able to deliver improvisationally something that somebody else has written. So one of the things that we always do is to say, if you've written something down, can you write it in a way that you would speak?
Mm.
I mean, I'm very conscious of this when I'm writing books, is I write in my own voice. So doing a voiceover or doing the audiobook version is really easy because I am writing how I talk. And I like to think that when people are reading it, they're hearing my voice in their heads when they're reading it.
Conversely, there are some people who go way too far to convince you that they're improvising. I mean, you've heard Shakespearean actors going, to be or not to be. That is... That classical text has to kind of invoke the two traditions, the rhetorical tradition, which is essentially reading aloud, and the naturalistic tradition. So I'm a big fan of balancing those two traditions between something formally delivered and something that sounds as if it's informal.
I love that. And, you know, there are huge parallels in music, because usually in music, particularly classical, musical theatre, some contemporary, the music is written already. The melody is written, the rhythm is written, the feel is written, the vibe is written. And you basically need to work within those rules and still find something that's yours, that's unique.
But that goes back to passion, because there's got to be something about it that is you. Because it takes me back to the idea of what Paul was saying about the Shakespeare. You've got to find something personal in it that you can deliver, that we relate to as an audience. So it does feel real and natural. But at the same time, you're honouring, if you like, the construction of the text in that situation.
You're talking about passion, yes.
Yeah, and it's the same, we talk about making the song your own, and that is finding that moment in the song. Why do you want to deliver that song to someone else? What's the point of singing it?
It's one of my favourite things to ask, which is, why are you saying this?
Mm. Or sometimes I will put it provocatively, why are you taking up my time? You know, what is it that's so goddamn important that you want to take up my time to do this and make them argue for the importance of it in that way?
Mm. Yeah. Love it.
Yeah.
Can you pick from the later chapters in your book and pick out some nuggets?
Yes. I think chapter 13 is probably my favorite. Problem 3, I'm not good at riffing. So for those of you who don't know what riffing is, it is essentially creating around the material. So you can take a sentence and reword it, or you take a melody and you reshape it. You sing different notes, you sing different rhythms, you use different words. Jazz singers do this a lot. It's actually part of the style, sometimes to the point where you don't even recognize the original melody. Riffing is a skill. It's a skill that can be learned and taught. And I think riffing is so useful for people who are going to be appearing on podcasts or interviews, anything where there's a conversation. And if the host is well prepared, which thankfully you are, Paul, thank you, they will throw something at you that you're not prepared for. And so you have to improvise. You have to you know, find some way of answering the question.
And that's suddenly very real for the listener, isn't it? Suddenly you know that the person has got no chance of quoting from memory or from their preparation. They're on the spot. And we enjoy that vulnerability, I think.
Yes. And it's really interesting because people have different techniques to do it. And one of the things I recommend if you're going to do an interview or a podcast is to actually listen to the host or listen to episodes and find out how different guests do it. Yes.
Yeah, be sure to do your homework because good riffing improvisation requires structure. If you're not confident that your host is going to ask you the leading questions you want, you need to prepare them. If you're not used to doing podcasts, listen to other podcasts that host has delivered and listen to how other guests manage it.
There's an exercise that I have got in the book, which I think is really relevant to that. We're going to assume that you have been invited to do something and you're there for a specific reason. So you have a specific topic or set of topics that you're going to talk about. In my case, you know, I've got a book, so I've got chapters and chapter headings, which is really useful. You take the chapter heading or the title of your topic, and this is at home when you practice, and you write, let's say you have five topics, you write them on postcards and you hand them to your friend. And the friend hands one back to you and you have 30 seconds to talk about that topic. And you have a stopwatch and off you go. And then they hand you another topic. Now, these are all topics that you know about. You just don't know which order they're going to come in. And also you have this 30-second time thing that you have to carry on talking until the end. You then hand the cards back when you finish and they do it again and you talk for a minute.
Yeah, this sounds very Elizabethan, learning to anatomize a topic and go for, what did they call it? Copiousness and anatomizing a topic. Very good practice. What's the radio game where you have to talk for 30 seconds without repetition?
Just a minute.
You've got a minute to talk about something. That's a very good parlor game at home to play in preparation for any kind of public speaking, don't you think?
It is. Mm. And also on the Elizabethan theme, this exercise works very well with wine. It's going to sound odd to say, but there are things that you need to practice. Having this level of improvisatory skill is not something that is natural. You need to practice certain things. And then once you've done the practice, and I know you'll know this, once you've done the practice, you let go.
Mm-hmm.
And you just go, I'm going to react to whatever is in front of me.
What you're saying is knowing your subject isn't enough to make you a good podcast guest.
Absolutely. You can be the best expert in the world and a terrible speaker.
Mm.
So all of this that we've talked about is great for podcast guests and great for anyone who speaks for a living or wants to be an impressive speaker.
Yes.
Mm. This has been great. Thank you for joining me again, Julianne and Jeremy.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you too for inviting us, Paul.
Happy holidays. And thanks to you for joining me, Paul Meyer, and my guests, Julianne Kayes and Jeremy Fisher. For full information about them and their company, Vocal Process, go to paulmeyer.com, choose In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services tab on the menu bar, and click episode number 83. Don't forget to follow Paul Meyer Dialect Services on Facebook and me on X or Twitter at @DialectPaul. Email me with your comments and questions, paul@paulmeyer.com. Next month, my guest is Arik Kirschenbaum, author of the best-selling book, Why Animals Talk. Our first topic, not focused on humans. You'll never think about speech the same way again. Tune in next time to In a Manner of Speaking.